You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org Medscape Cardiology, and this is This Week in Cardiology for June 16th, 2017. This week, aspirin use in the elderly, deprescribing statins, an American Diabetes Association meeting wrap-up, and education level in cardiovascular disease. The lead story this week is important. It's about aspirin use in the elderly. First, some background. Now, everyone agrees that aspirin use increases the risk of bleeding, but what's not appreciated is how high that risk is and what the consequences of these bleeds can be. In general, many clinicians and patients, too, consider the risk of bleeding with aspirin as more of a nuisance and not enough to cancel out its secondary prevention benefits. And here's the thing, though, on aspirin-induced secondary prevention. The only truly positive study for aspirin is the ISIS-2 trial, which included a 28-day follow-up, so very short follow-up. Meta-analyses of aspirin for secondary prevention were mostly neutral and included studies done many decades ago. Well, that's why this most recent observational trial published in The Lancet from researchers in the UK is so valuable. These researchers quantified the degree of aspirin-induced associated bleeding. This was a prospective population-based study in patients followed for over a decade who were given aspirin for secondary prevention reasons. The study included around 3,200 patients given aspirin, and half were older than age 75. Of the 405 first bleeding events, half were GI bleeding. There were 45 intracranial hemorrhages and 142 other bleeds. Now, most of these bleeds on aspirin were serious and required hospital admission. Major bleeding increased steeply with age. For greater than 75 years of age, the hazard ratio was 3.1, and for fatal bleeds, the increase in bleeding for the elderly was over fivefold, and this was sustained during long-term follow-up. At age 75 years or older, major upper GI bleeds, now this is just GI bleeds, were mostly disabling or fatal, 62%. Now that's versus 47% of patients with recurrent ischemic stroke. And GI bleeds also outnumbered disabling or fatal intracerebral hemorrhages by a factor of 45 to 18. Now, another interesting aspect of this study was that the authors looked at the protective effect of PPI use, proton pump inhibitors, and they estimated that the number needed to treat the NNT for routine PPI use to prevent one disabling or fatal upper GI bleed over 5 years fell from 338 for younger people all the way down to 25 for individuals aged 85 years or older. Now, I have numerous comments on this study. First, Sue Hughes from Medscape Neurology has an incredible news story on this. Every one of her paragraphs is great, and this article is a great read, and I'd highly recommend it. The second thing to say is this is an observational study. Now, it doesn't tell us to stop using aspirin in the elderly for secondary prevention, but it does teach us that aspirin use in the elderly comes with significant bleeding trade-offs. In the clinic, I often cite the BAFTA trial, that's B-A-F-T-A trial, which was an RCT of aspirin versus warfarin in elderly patients with AF. And this RCT found that major bleeding, including intracranial hemorrhage, was similar in both groups. So the message is that aspirin use in the elderly is not necessarily the safer antithrombotic agent. One major quibble I had with the study's conclusions was that this data is not enough to warrant more widespread use of proton pump inhibitors, at least in my opinion. I worry about the use of proton pump inhibitors as well in terms of their adverse effects. Now, a better solution may be to listen to the comments of Dr. Cleland, who was cited in a news story, and his point is that rather than starting a PPI to reduce the risk of GI bleeding, maybe it's better to not use aspirin in the first place, or at least not use aspirin in the long term. Of course, the best solution would be a pragmatic RCT looking at aspirin deprescribing after a year or so, or if you want to propose PPI use, I think we should have a randomized trial. Next topic is deprescribing. Now, one of the more striking failures of common sense in medicine is when a patient with life-limiting disease is still taking a preventive therapy, such as a statin. I mean, statins in the best case reduce outcomes by single digits over a 5 to 10 year period. And how does this help a patient who has disseminated cancer or dementia or end-stage heart failure? One of the barriers, however, to deprescribing medications is clinicians' perceptions regarding what patients would think. That's why I was drawn to the results of a recent study published in the Journal of Palliative Medicine. These researchers used data from a previously published pragmatic trial of statin discontinuation. The parent trial was published in JAMA Internal Medicine in 2015. For this most current analysis, nearly 300 patients who had good cognition were given a 9-item questionnaire addressing their concerns about deprescribing. And get this, fewer than 5% agreed that stopping their statin meant that their doctor had been giving up on treating me or thinks that I'm about to die. Many participants, on the other hand, reported benefits of stopping the statins, including spending less money on medications, potentially stopping other medications, and having a better quality of life. An important caveat of this study is that it may be a select population, because willingness to enroll in the parent trial may select for patients who are at least open to the idea of stopping the statins. But I highlight the study because stopping medications that are no longer useful is simply the right thing to do. I also wish more patients and doctors understood that medications, like cardiac devices, may cease to be beneficial over time. And one of the major points of follow-up visits is to review the utility of these devices and medications. Next topic is an American Diabetes Association meeting wrap-up. I got 3 comments. The first one is that researchers from North Carolina showed in a pragmatic trial that routine self-monitored blood glucose in type 2 diabetes patients did not improve hemoglobin A1c levels or quality of life. And this study exactly confirms a similar study from the UK published 10 years ago by Farmer et al. Second comment on the ADA meeting is that in 2 RCTs, the PCSK9 drug alirocumab lowered blood lipid levels significantly. But we already knew these drugs do that. What we need to know is outcomes in diabetics, and for that we'll have to wait longer. The third comment is that in a New England Journal of Medicine published RCT, the sodium glucose cotransporter 2 inhibitor, canagliflozin, reduced CV events, not CV mortality. It also reduced the rate of renal decline, but the drug also doubled the rate of lower limb amputations. These results were less impressive than the empagliflozin was in the EMPA-REG trial. Remember that empagliflozin actually reduced all-cause and CV death. However, keep in mind that last week, in a letter to the New England Journal of Medicine, 3 Harvard researchers briefly presented an observational analysis from a large claims database in the U.S., and they found a 2-fold greater risk of diabetic ketoacidosis with the SGLT2 inhibitors compared to DPP4 drugs. This issue with the diabetic ketoacidosis bears watching. Finally, I'd like to talk about education levels and their association with cardiovascular outcomes. It's well known that zip code influences one's long-term health, but a new study published in JAMA Internal Medicine looks at the effects of educational level on cardiovascular disease risk. The authors used a longitudinal population-based ERIC study, that's Atherosclerosis Risk in Communities, ARIC study, and they followed almost 14,000 individuals from 4 U.S. communities over more than 3 decades. This analysis of this database revealed that education level mattered a lot. The lifetime cardiovascular disease risks range from 59% for people with grade school education to 42% for graduate and professional school education. And in women, the rates from lowest to highest education was 50% down to 28%. Now, crucially, the authors noted that gaps in CVD risks related to education appeared in younger, middle-aged people. And those who completed more than a high school education had a lower lifetime risk of cardiovascular disease, regardless of their income, occupation, or parental educational attainment, compared with those who do not complete high school. The lifetime risk method cannot, however, directly assess which intermediate risk factor explains the association of education with lifetime CVD risk. This study makes the podcast this week because it speaks to better ways to lower the burden of heart disease. Whereas statins, aspirin, PCSK9 inhibitors, and other medical interventions get lots of attention, I believe it's the more basic factors that make real differences. Basic factors like having more of our citizens attain higher levels of education. So that's it for this week in cardiology. I'm grateful that you listened. Thank you. Until next week, this is John Mandrola from the Heart.org Medscape Cardiology.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from the Heart.org on Medscape.